This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
This episode is sort of a continuation after the first Santa episode.
It's a continuation of our public service announcement.
To start with, I did want to say that the Kingsport Police Department in Tennessee is asking for public assistance related to a body that was found in, or a death that occurred in 2003. It's now been ruled to be a
suspicious death.
And I only mention this is because for some reason they started asking, it's 18 years later, and that always like makes me wonder what's going on. But
that makes me think that investigators dropped the ball and somebody else has come in and gone through the files.
I would love to think that that happens, but I don't. I mean, I'm with you. That's the optimistic point of view. Usually, I think what happens is somebody says something and then somebody else tries to use what that person said to bargain with. That's my opinion.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I think it involves, like, people from the initial crime somehow getting into jail. But that's just weird because it's 18 years ago. So this is the article. It's from the TimesNews.net. It just released. It's December 13th.
It's about 23 hours old. Yeah.
Yeah. The Kingsport Police Department is asking for public assistance to solve the suspicious death of a Kingsport woman in 2003. A resident discovered the body of Joyce Ann McBride, 51, in a vacant lot in the 1800 block of Lowell Drive and contacted police about 6:30 a.m. on March the 8th. And I assume they're saying March the 8th, 2003. Police said that McBride had several visible abrasions, contusions on her face and body. Based upon the initial on-scene investigation, she was not believed to have been there very long. Police sent McBride's body to the East Tennessee State University College of Medicine for autopsy. The medical examiner indicated the cause of her death was blunt force trauma. However, the manner of death was undetermined. So they don't know if this might have been like a car accident type situation or if this was more a beating or other type of death. Police classified the case as suspicious death. It remains under the investigation by the KPD Criminal Investigations Division. And a release issued this Monday, KPD said several leads have been followed throughout the years. However, none have yielded a definitive conclusion as to what exactly happened to McBride. It's our desire that bringing some renewed attention to this cold case will help spark some memories and generate new leads, which could potentially assist with this investigation and hopefully bring some much-needed closure to the friends, family, and loved ones of Ms. McBride. And that's in the press release. You guys can look her up. Joyce Ann McBride, she was 51 at the time. If anyone lives in Tennessee and knows anything about this case, they would like to hear from you because they're trying to clear this one up. My guess is it turns out to be something related to a vehicle. I don't know that. I mean, I'm guessing.
Seems like that would be more than just some visible abrasions and contusions, but maybe not.
Maybe she just hit her head or something. I don't know. I mean, they didn't release any other information and they don't call it a homicide. They call it a suspicious death. So I'm putting, like, it could be a fall. Some kind of fall, or it could be some kind of vehicle accident. It could also be a beating. They're just not giving us that information right here. Now that I looked at that again, I'm thinking maybe they just got some cold case money and they're trying to follow up on some unsolved.
It's possible,
deaths.
Sure. Yeah.
So either way, like that's good. We want to close these cases. That's like a huge thing. Last episode, in our Days of Christmas, episodes of Christmas, we talked about Bruce Pardo. And you said it was a public service announcement that if a relative shows up at your house.
An estranged relative,
someone you don't have a lot of contact with, someone maybe is not your favorite relative, in a Santa suit carrying packages, be suspicious. Be very suspicious.
Yeah, because it hasn't gone well in a couple of situations.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about another one. We're going to limit ourselves to two Santas, but we felt like people needed some Santa murder, I guess.
I have to ask you, are there really more?
Oh yeah, there's more. I'm for real. Those are the two that like, I felt like in the context of what you wanted to do, I felt like those are the two that made sense because people know who Bruce Pardoe is. I think that's an easy case to cover. This one, I don't think people know as much, but it does show up, you know, in a few listicles here and there. Some of the others are more unknown. There are lots of crimes committed by people in Santa suits, and the murder side of it is a little different. There's a lot of robberies and stuff that happen in Santa
suits. But it's not, but as far, so to me, these cases are, I mean, I feel like Bruce's was slightly more extreme because of the whole pyromania thing. There's not a lot of these cases, right?
What do you mean?
Just like
narrow it down to like these cases.
Okay. Santa being a father, uncle, patriarchal type figure going into a large family gathering and killing everybody.
Okay. So, all right, this is going to get complicated. So I pulled Santa crimes and I can run through them. I made a list for you in case you asked, because I know how you like to have sources and stuff.
No,
seriously.
No. I was just curious because I don't feel like this happens that much.
I was not necessarily referencing just this part of it. But I was talking Santa crimes. Sue.
Yeah. Sure.
So on New Year's Eve of 2017, in Istanbul, Turkey, at around 1:45 in the morning, a man dressed in a Santa Claus costume showed up outside of a packed nightclub. They were celebrating New Year's Eve. So he pulls up. He has a long-barreled gun. He murders a policeman and a civilian outside the club, and he makes his way inside. So he's inside a nightclub that has hundreds of people partying at it's New Year's Eve. He opens fire on the club floor. He kills 39 people, and he wounds an additional 69, and another 100 are wounded in the melee afterwards. He then vanishes. Turns out it was Abu Muhammad Haransani. They do find him 2 weeks later. He had $200,000 cash on him. He had more firearms. He had so much ammunition, you wouldn't believe it. And he even had drones that he had been using to monitor police activity.
Sarah, was he just like straight up crazy?
He claimed ISIS, but like there were never any connections made.
Terrorism. So, great.
Yeah. So Santa terrorist was that.
Right. Well, and I'm not surprised by that at all. That to me, that's kind of a different level because of it wasn't somebody's family in their house basically. But yeah. So no, that was a terrible crime though. I'm glad they caught him.
Well, so on October 31st, 2017, a man dressed as Santa Claus in Austin, Texas, was told by the guests at his own party that it was time for him to go to bed. According to witnesses, Randall Gaston Jones was highly intoxicated as the Halloween party continued on till around 6 a.m. the next morning. After being told to calm down and call it a night, Jones went into a bedroom and returned with a gun. Michael McCloskey, the guest who chose to confront Jones, ended up being shot several times, while three other partygoers were also showered with bullets in the process. When police were finally called to Jones's home, they found the victims covered in blood. And tragically, Mike McCloskey died from his gunshot wounds, but Jones was promptly taken into custody. That's not even Christmas, and it's crazy Santa.
Right, and for what it's worth, if you need to tell the host of the party to go to bed, I think you should probably just go home.
Yeah, I think it's time to go home.
Because that's not going to end well.
No. Yep. There's lots of fictional stories about Santa.
I just wanted to make sure that what you're saying is true, but I also feel like my perception remains intact because I guess my thought was that I'm hoping that this, you know, that Bruce Pardoe's situation and what he did isn't run of the mill. And it's not. And I mean, we do have another. I was genuinely surprised that there were two of these situations that sort of, you know, they were vengeful specifically to terrorize an ex-wife and family.
It's interesting because there are a lot of Christmas massacres that happen even those are not frequently family related, if that makes sense. Like, Christmas time massacres are not uncommon. Family Christmas time massacres are more rare.
I feel like massacres in and of themselves are uncommon.
Yeah, they are way less common today than they used to be. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway.
So this is a different one. I actually did not know this one. When you were talking about this, I was like looking through old, I don't know what you want to call them, but like sort of like lists to find less covered things. And basically, if it was on every list, I didn't want it. This is now making its round to the lists.
I was wondering if it, so this happened in 2011, I believe.
Yeah, this was December 2011.
Okay, and so do you think that it's possible that it was inspired by the 2008 rampage of Bruce Pardo?
That's a good question. There's so much going on in this situation. I don't know if it needed much inspiration. The estranged husband of a woman showed up at his wife's, but estranged wife or separated wife's apartment on Christmas morning dressed like Saint Nick. And he opened fire shortly after the family had unwrapped presents. This is Aziz Yazdanpana. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. There were six victims in this shooting. They were Nazrin Ramadi, 55, who is Aziz's wife. Nona Yazdanpana, who was 19, that was his daughter. Ali Yazdanpana, 15, who was his son. Zore Ramadi, who was his wife's sister, she was 58. And Hossein Zarai, who was his brother-in-law, he was 59. And then his niece, Sara Zari, was 22. These were popular Iranian-Americans, and they owned a lot of land down in Dallas, Texas, and they had a couple of little event locations where they, I picture like weddings happening there. But this takes place in, I believe it's Grapevine, Texas is the specific locations. Roger Eberling of the Grapevine Police Department says that the appearance we get is that leading up to this was just a normal Christmas gathering. It was unclear whether Aziz was invited to the apartment, but it said it looked like he did not force his way inside. Around 11:16 a.m., Eberling said a female victim sent a text message to a friend indicating the family had just exchanged gifts and that the gunman was there dressed as Santa Claus.
She didn't call him the gunman, though.
No, this is Eberling. This is the police trying to put it all together. Here, I'll say it a different way. Around 11:16 a.m., Eberling said a female victim sent a text message to a friend indicating the family had just exchanged gifts and Santa Claus was there. The text messages say, so we're here. We just got here. And my uncle is here too, dressed as Santa. Awesome, she said in one text. This is a 22-year-old girl, and this is a text that she sent to her boyfriend just before 11 a.m. At 11:15 a.m., she texted and said, now he wants to be all fatherly and win Father of the Year. Obviously, there's something going on between all of these people.
Sounds to me like there was not a plan for him to be there.
Yeah, I think he just showed up. I think your public service announcement applies here. No question. Particularly if someone, I don't know, if they are invited and they show up as Santa, you might want to like raise an eyebrow at them. So according to Eberling's account for this, they got a 911 call, which initially sounded like silence. That was around 11:23 a.m. After listening to the call again, police could hear someone in a raspy voice saying, help me. He said the caller sounded out of breath and the call went dead after 15 to 20 seconds. Police arrived within minutes where they found the bodies of all six victims and the gunman and two handguns found among the wrapping paper and the Christmas tree. Nazrin Ramadi had been separated from her husband since March, according to NBC affiliate WFAA. Ramadi and her two children had moved into the Grapevine, Texas apartment where they were murdered, while Aziz reportedly remained in the family's Colleyville, Texas home. The home had been foreclosed on in 2010.
no electricity or water.
That'd make anybody crazy. Aziz had been having financial troubles after his real estate business slowed down and he had reportedly filed for bankruptcy. And if you go online and read, the social media is still out there for this. This is one of those cases that took place where, you know, they got a memorial page on Facebook. And if you look at it, people talking about it, they describe that they didn't see anything like this coming, but that they didn't necessarily have a good feeling about Aziz when they met him. Grapevine is a town that sits on about 16 square miles near Dallas. And the last homicide had been more than a year before this. They never had a situation like this where this many victims were shot and killed. This is a crazy story. And the 911 call with the help me is not, that's disturbing in itself. Over time, the Dallas Morning News digs into this case, and they said about a year later, on December 24, 2012, that documents bring a glimpse of the troubled life of the Grapevine mass shooter. The Grapevine police didn't know what to do with this, so they basically build this massive investigation like they were having to prosecute someone, although they don't. But they put a report together, and they released it, sort of showing what had happened. It's 85-page Grapevine police report, documents the deadliest crime in the city's history, offers new insight into the mindset of the Iranian-born father of two in the time before he became an internationally known mass murderer. Among the findings in the police report, he told a friend that he and Zari would lie to their wives about trips they took in which they would get hotel rooms with prostitutes. Zari apparently told his wife about only what Aziz was doing on those trips. And that may have played a role in the separation from his wife. So
wait, that was his brother-in-law that he killed.
So he feels like his brother-in-law, would you call that a selling him out, I think, or tattling on him?
Take your pick.
So
I also am not entirely certain that any of that actually happened. I mean, as far as, like, he might have just been up to no good and his brother-in-law told on him, but he wasn't involved.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the way that it ended up turning out. I don't know if this has come up. Actually, go ahead. Sorry.
The same friend told police that Aziz probably would have been deeply offended not being invited to the Christmas party, and that Aziz felt like his wife's sister was constantly interfering with his marriage. Aziz's wife had told her apartment manager that she was afraid of Aziz, and she had told her colleagues, at least one who told police, that he was not taking the impending divorce very well. Aziz, by the way, went by Bob, and one of his Colleyville, Texas neighbors referred to him as Packing Heat Bob. He had once spoken out about carrying a gun because he was having problems with one of his daughter's boyfriends.
Well, it's a good thing he was there to protect her from the boyfriend so he could kill her himself.
So as you said, the house had no electricity, no running water, and there was very little furniture left there at the time. It was a big deal that she talked to her coworkers. This is the wife that I'm talking about, because she was pretty private. They were all pretty private. The end result for all of this, like everyone dying, was blindsiding to all of these people. Some of the coworkers who were close to Ramadi, I don't know how you say it. I've got a family tree sitting in front of me, and I think I'm saying some of these names different now than I said them previously, but Ramadi, Fatma Ramadi, had several conversations about how Aziz was not providing for the family, as was his Muslim responsibility. This is why she was actually seeking the divorce. Aziz was more upset when the family moved into the apartment than when he was told about the divorce. So it was just getting worse for him. Everyone around Aziz said they were stunned. They said he was friendly, he was generous, and sometimes he was a little creepy. They would drink and they would hang out together with this guy, John Mira, had known him for about a year. They were hanging out in Colleyville at a place called Gloria's Restaurant. And he said that Aziz was always telling jokes. But this is also a guy that supposedly is running off and seeing prostitutes potentially. John Mira had been through a divorce before, and he was counseling his friend about family problems, according to his interviews. he was having a particular problem with his sister-in-law and the whole marriage interference thing. Another friend, Mark Bagleri, told police that Aziz said his sister-in-law had control over his wife and children, and they would listen to her when she began to call him evil. So Bagleri, who is also from Iran, said in a phone interview that he had spoken to Aziz shortly before Christmas Eve, and he was planning to attend the party hosted by his wife's sister and her husband. The fact that he was apparently told he was not welcome and they would rather he didn't come may have been the final breaking point. And in Bagleri's interview, he said they denied him his pride and they took his family away. I don't know what to say to this, but this sounds like it was a family that was turning on one of their own, and probably for some good reason. I don't know exactly what
it
did.
I would imagine the prostitutes and the lack of water and electricity at the home would be a starting point there.
Yeah, but like, okay, yes.
If you don't have electricity running for your house, which his kids were older, right? How old were they? 14, 16?
The utilities were shut off because of the foreclosure. He didn't even own the home anymore. He should have been living there. That's not anything to do with his ability to provide. The foreclosure was on his.
She left a house to move to an apartment because there was no running water or electricity.
I understand
that. His wife had left him in a house that had no electricity or running water and little furniture at the time of his death.
Had left him. He wasn't allowed to move with her.
Right, but that gives the impression that the reason she left was because there was no water or electricity.
It gives me the impression that she had left him, and that was his complaint to people. Like, she had left him there, and his complaint was there's no running water, no electricity. He felt abandoned by his wife. But the reason the water and electricity are off is because the house had been foreclosed for like a year. Nobody wanted to buy it yet, so it was just
okay. Stuck. Well, I see it as his wife.
I can see that too,
because he was not providing for them, and I feel like the sister, with her husband having told the family that they were going, like, he was spending money on prostitutes and going to hotels. That's where what I was getting at. Okay.
I gotcha.
If you are not keeping, you know, the fundamentals for your children,
but you're seeing prostitutes in hotels,
then there's a problem. And, you know, she had moved to an apartment and she was working two jobs. Right.
I think she moved in with her sister based on what they're saying here.
I don't know if they all live there or not, but either way, she was working two jobs and he doesn't sound like he was doing much except hanging out with some people at Gloria's and planning this horrible attack, basically, is what it seems like. I don't know how much time had transpired necessarily. Most of his friends that they talked to in the interview had known him for about a year. So I'm guessing that's when he made those friends.
No matter what, he made a very poor decision in how he was going to handle his family's Christmas affairs.
It has always been my opinion that in the event you are unwelcome to something, so in this particular instance, according to his friend, it was the breaking point where he was basically told not to come to the family Christmas gathering. I personally think that that would be immature to uninvite a parent of my child's, right? Yeah. If they were invited to begin with. But I've always told myself that I don't ever want to be anywhere I'm not welcome, right? I feel like that would have gone a long way here because, you know, he could have had.
No kidding. Do you think it's like, okay, it's got to be petty, right?
Well, he killed his own children.
But I'm saying no matter what his like explanation of what's going on is, it's got to be something petty going on here, right? I know that part's petty, but like, why would you subject yourself to going to your in-law's house? He had to, like, this had to be the plan. This is the only reason he was going, or was it an either or situation? Like, they'll either love me or I'll kill them.
Well, I don't know. I don't think that he was planning this the whole time. I think when he was uninvited, I think that's when it became like, I'll show you.
Yeah, that sort of makes sense to me too. I was just curious if that's what you thought.
And based on the niece's text to her boyfriend, it's clear. I mean, she was older. I think all the kids were older. But the niece, I believe, was maybe in her 20s. And, you know, it's clear that she's referencing the fact that, like, he has turned into this black sheep. And, you know, he was ratted out, if that's how you want to put it, by his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law indicates, and Aziz indicates that they both were doing this stuff. He doesn't make any kinds of denial, right? He just says, well, wait, he was doing it too.
he does.
And so, you know, he's betrayed by his brother-in-law, who he was clearly close with. The brother-in-law's wife is his wife's sister. And so he despises her. So he feels like, and, you know, maybe they were both doing the same things and he's the one who got screwed. And maybe the sister-in-law was in denial. Who knows? But all of this is petty. All of it. And it doesn't make any sense to be so mad at your sister-in-law that you kill your own children.
I can't imagine thinking that it would be fun. Like, I can definitely see wanting to spend time with your children at the holidays, even open gifts or whatever. But I can't imagine that it would ever be fun just based on it sounds horrible, but the victim list. I'm not knocking those people. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if I were in Aziz's role, other than my children, those are the last people on the planet that I would want to be stuck in a room with.
Right. No kidding. And they didn't want him there. And that was almost, you know, the fact that those are the last people in the world he would want to be stuck with and they didn't want him there. I feel like that's where you tell yourself, I don't want to be anywhere I'm not welcome. And the fact that he was being trashed, and I feel like maybe the cultural aspect of this is a little more than it might be for just people who don't have, they were Iranian, right? And I assume Muslim, is that right?
They're Iranian and Muslim, yes.
Okay. And so I feel like it was a stab at his manhood.
They were stabs at his manhood being taken by the sister-in-law and by his, like, the place that he had gotten himself into. The thing is, like, up until the foreclosure, their life is pretty uneventful.
And I understand, though, that when you've got people against you in this type of situation, because, you know, as far as I can imagine what's happening, as far as the sister possibly being in denial that her husband was also doing bad things and, you know, her trying to look out for her sister. And there's probably some vicariousness occurring there, possibly. But I can see where he would be very downtrodden and feeling like everybody was against him, which is more than likely why he killed everybody. But when you're in situations like that, you have to show everybody that you're going to change. You can't say it. You can't show up and make everything better.
That's what I was going to say. You have two options in this situation, and neither of them involve wearing a Santa Claus suit and going to your ex-family's house ever. These are your two options. One, wallow in your pity for a little bit and find some help. Find someone, some kind of support network, whether it's your own family or mental health professionals or an 800 line. And, you know, the truth is, if you call about anywhere, you could call a domestic violence hotline. You could call a sexual assault hotline. You could call any 800 number. And even if it's not your bailiwick, it's not the thing that's going on with you, they can probably find you someone to talk to either there or at the appropriate 800 number. That's just how people are.
Right. So, but you can also text these days. I'm just saying.
Well, I don't know about 2011 for this guy, but yeah. So the other side of this is, I think your phraseology is appropriate, but I'm going to add to it. You have to just pick yourself up and figure out where you're going. You don't have to like be married to this person and have this situation going on. You don't have to not be married. You know, whatever works out, works out. You don't have to be super rich. You just have to have a direction and a goal. It doesn't matter what the goal is. Just go that way. Go towards that goal, whatever it is. Even right. if you and fail, do it again.
If you want to be seeing prostitutes at hotel rooms, then don't be surprised when your wife leaves and goes to live in an apartment with or without her sister.
I'm not even going to chastise people who do that. If that's your thing.
I mean, if that's what you want to do, it's not fair to your wife. I'm not chastising anybody. I'm just saying, don't expect your wife to be happy about it. I mean, own it either way, don't you think?
I don't care. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't care what he does. I'm not judging him for that either. Like, I understand like why that would be a sore spot. That's irrelevant to the situation. Because if that woman knew that like chastising him about a prostitute or whatever was going to end the way it ended, like you always say, she probably would have figured out a different way to approach that.
I feel like if you're right. I feel like now, granted, we get into a sort of emotional abuse territory here, in that, you know, if like we were talking about with Bruce, if Sylvia had known it was going to end the way it did, she probably wouldn't have filed for divorce from him. And then she's stuck in that situation. In this situation, the same thing. I doubt very seriously she would have filed for divorce from Aziz, knowing that he was going to come and kill everybody. And honestly,
I don't know about that. I think some of these people would have gotten far, far away from the other people. Judging their actions for wanting to get out of their situations either. This is not victim blaming.
No.
Like this is just a matter of like that. That's certain things happen. It's like a butterfly effect. This little thing that happens has this long reaching effect in the future that you don't even understand. And I do believe that there are ways to confront situations like this with the appropriate types of professionals. Some of these people need lawyers. Some of these people need the police. And some of these people need therapists. You never know which one needs which. And that doesn't mean just because they're seeing a therapist that they're staying together. But if you like told me that this guy that everybody seen him in the last year thinks he's laughing and joking and whatever at a bar or a restaurant, that guy like his downfall here is that he saw a prostitute in a motel or prostitutes in a motel. That's not my problem with him. I don't care about that part. The prostitutes in the motels are the least of his worry. Do they give you an inkling to some type of character? Maybe not. Maybe. But like, maybe it is that like that's where his focus was. It could also be that like he decided since nothing else was going right in his life that he was going to start doing that. You're right. He should tell his wife and get away from her. But if all you're going to do is, and this is not these people, this is in general, if all you're going to do is meddle in other people's lives, whether you're a brother-in-law or sister-in-law yourself, try and do it without the brutal part. Because people think that brutal honesty is a thing. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you, all of you listening right now, your brutal honesty doesn't help anyone more than the honesty. The brutal part can go away. You don't need to be brutally honest. It's ridiculous. It actually makes you look like a giant asshole. Here's what you can do. You can just say what you're thinking and what you're feeling as politely as possible. And guess what? You'll get better results.
I agree.
That's like, you know, you and I have stuck pretty well, the two of us. We have our personality quirks. It's the holidays.
You mean against each other or just in general?
In general.
Okay.
We have our both. But we have stuck pretty well to like rules. We have rules. You don't put your hands on other people. You don't like be unnecessarily rude to other people. And even when we have outright shouting matches with each other, which we have as adults, because like we spend a lot of time working together creatively, we both honestly have very small social circles. So in this situation, if there was a Santa Claus coming to the door, there's a strong possibility we might be hanging out at the same party. So my point is, we've learned how to figure out how to be honest with each other I believe that you're that way with your spouse and your kids. I'm that way with my spouse and my kids. And that's probably one of the most important lessons you can take away from true crime. You can change everything for the better just by being positive people.
Right. And I would say if you're incapable of being positive, at least don't be cruel.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
And I think that Aziz was well aware that what he had done was wrong. Perhaps he regretted it. I don't see that he denied it. And it seems to me like you don't ever need to tell a parent, a spouse, a father, a mother, even a child, if you're older, you don't ever need to tell them that they're failing in life, because if you can see it, you can rest assured that they can see it. And I feel like sometimes the best thing to do in that type of situation is to offer whatever advice you have. Otherwise, keep your mouth shut. And so his brother-in-law, instead of ratting him out, could have, in this situation, I'm not saying he did anything wrong. I'm sure he did whatever. He may have been trying to save himself, but, you know, he could have said, hey, why don't you give my buddy a call? He needs some help, you know, a job opportunity, basically. And, you know, the sister-in-law could have said, well, you know, let's have him over and let's talk and see, you know, be more helpful. You don't ever want to be the poison in someone else's relationship, though. And if you're in a relationship, you should always talk about your problems that you're having with the person you're having them with first. Because that way you're not clouding the environment, right? Because once you've talked junk about your husband to your sister's never going to see him the same way again.
Yeah, we are not qualified to give anyone on here relationship advice. I just want to make that disclaimer now.
Well, so I'm just saying,
I want to tell a different story because we're still doing Christmas stories, but I like this one. This is a more positive story as far as the life goes, and it makes the tragedy even worse. A guy named Harry Moore was born November 18th, 1905 in Houston, Florida, which is a tiny farming community in Sewanee County. He's the only child of Johnny and Rosa Moore. His father tended to water tanks for Seaboard Airline Railroad and ran a small store in front of their home. He started having health issues when Harry was only 9 years old, his dad was, and he died that year in 1914. Rosa, his widow, tried to manage alone. She worked in cotton fields, and she ran a small store on the weekends. In 1915, Rosa sent Harry to live with one of her sisters in Daytona Beach. And the following year, he moved to Jacksonville, where he lived for the next 3 years with three other aunts, Jessie, Adriana, and Macy Tyson, who shared a household. That would prove to be the most important period in his formative years. Jacksonville had a large and vibrant community around them, made up mostly of African Americans, with a proud tradition of independence and intellectual achievement. Harry Moore's aunts were educated, well-informed women. Two of them were educators and one was a nurse. They took this spindly, intelligent boy into their house on Louisiana Street, and they treated him like the son that they had never had. And under their guidance, Harry Moore's natural inquisitiveness and love of learning was reinforced. After 3 years in Jacksonville, he returned home to Sewanee County in 1919. He enrolled in the high school program at Florida Memorial College, and over the next 4 years, Moore excelled in his studies. His classmates nicknamed him Doc. And in May of 1925, at the age of 19, he graduated from Florida Memorial College with a normal degree for teaching in elementary grade. He accepted a teaching job in Cocoa, Florida, which is down in Brevard County. For the next 2 years, Moore taught the fourth grade at Cocoa's only black elementary school. During his first year in Brevard County, he met an attractive older woman. Her name was Harriet Sims. She was 23. He had just turned 20. She had taught school herself, but by then she was selling insurance for the Atlanta Life Insurance Company, a black-owned business at the time, with some serious clout. Within a year, they were married on Christmas Day, 1926. Both of the Moores completed degrees at Bethune-Cookman College, which is a historically black college in Daytona Beach. The Sims family lived in Mims, a small citrus town outside the county seat of Titusville. But the newlyweds moved in with Harriet's parents while they were building their own house on an adjoining acre of land. Meanwhile, Harry had been promoted to the position of principal at Titusville Colored School, which went fourth through ninth grades. He taught the ninth grade, and he supervised a staff of six teachers. On March 28, 1928, their eldest daughter, Anne Rosalie, nicknamed Peaches, was born. When Peaches was 6 months old, Harriet began teaching at the Mims Colored School. And on September 30, 1930, their baby daughter, Juanita Evangeline, was born. Both of their daughters also earned college degrees at Bethune-Cookman College. Back in 1934, soon after the birth of their daughters, the Moores founded the Brevard County chapter of the NAACP. Moore also helped organize the statewide NAACP organization. Through his registration activities, he greatly increased the number of members, and he worked on issues of housing and education. He investigated lynchings. He filed lawsuits against voter registration barriers and white primaries. He worked for equal pay for black teachers in public schools, even though they were segregated. In 1946, both Moores were fired from their teaching jobs because of their activism. Harry Moore was working to gain equal pay for equal pay in Brevard County. Economic retaliation was widely used in southern states to discourage this type of activism. Harry Moore accepted a paid position with the NAACP in order to survive economically. He also led the Progressive Voters League. Following a 1944 U.S. Supreme Court ruling against white primaries as unconstitutional, which the Democratic Party had used as another means of excluding blacks from politics at the time. Between 1944 and 1950, Moore succeeded in increasing the registration of black voters in Florida to 31% of those eligible to vote, markedly higher than any other southern state. In July of 1949, four black men were accused of raping a white woman in Groveland, Florida. Ernest Thomas fled the county and was killed by a posse. The other three suspects were arrested and beaten while in custody, forcing two to confess. Rumors accompanied the case against a background of post-war tensions resulting from problems in absorbing veterans back into jobs and American society. In Groveland, a white mob of more than 400 people demanded that the sheriff, Willis V. McCall, who had hidden the prisoners to protect them, hand the prisoners over so they could be lynched. The mob left the jail and went on a rampage, burning buildings in the black district of town. McCall asked the governor to send in the National Guard, but 6 days were needed to restore order to the town. The three young men, one 16 years of age and a minor, were found guilty by an all-white jury. The judge sentenced 16-year-old Charles Greenlee to life in prison. Sam Shepard and Walter Irvin were sentenced to death. The executive director of the Florida NAACP, Harry Moore, organized a campaign against what he saw as the wrongful convictions of the three men. With NAACP support, appeals were pursued. And in April of 1951, a legal team headed by Thurgood Marshall won the appeal of Shepard and Irvin's convictions before the United States Supreme Court. A new trial was scheduled. County Sheriff McCall was responsible for transporting Shepard and Irvin to the new trial venue in November of 1951. He claimed that the two men, both handcuffed, attacked him during an escape attempt. He shot them both, and Shepard died at the scene. Irvin survived his wounds. He later claimed to the NAACP and FBI officials that the sheriff shot him and Shepard in cold blood. Moore called for an indictment against Sheriff McCall and called on Florida Governor Fuller Warren to suspend McCall from office. 6 weeks later, on Christmas night of 1951, on the Moore's 25th wedding anniversary, a bomb went off beneath the couple's house in Mims, Florida. Both were fatally injured. Harry Moore died on the way to the hospital in Sanford, Florida, which was about 30 miles away, but was the closest that would serve African Americans. His wife died from her injuries 9 days later at the same hospital. Moore has been called the first martyr in the civil rights movement. He was the first NAACP official assassinated in the civil rights struggle. He and his wife were the first couple to be killed for civil rights. The murders caused a national and international outcry, with protests registered at the United Nations against violence in the southern United States. The NAACP also held a huge rally in New York and in other cities, too. In many respects, the protests over the Morris murder were a forerunner of demonstrations during the civil rights movement. The NAACP sponsored a fundraising event at Madison Square Garden. A song titled The Ballad of Harry Moore was performed, with lyrics by poet Langston Hughes. The state of Florida called the Federal Bureau of Investigation to head the investigation, but the case was never solved and no one was ever prosecuted. The FBI was convinced that the Ku Klux Klan had committed the bombing and identified a number of local Klansmen as suspects, but they were never able to find enough evidence to bring charges. Eventually, the FBI indicted 7 Klansmen for lying about their involvement in other racial violence in the hope that the pressure of the indictments would force some of the Klansmen to crack and testify about the Moore case. However, this didn't work, and the indictments were eventually dismissed. The FBI officially closed the Moore investigation in 1953. The case has been reopened, though, 3 times. In 1978 by Brevard County, from 1991 to 1992 by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or FDLE, and in 2005 by Florida Attorney General Charlie Crist. In October 2006, 3 weeks before winning the Republican primary for governor, Crist held a press conference in Mims. He claimed that he had resolved the case. Although his investigation found no new evidence, he identified 4 dead Klansmen as the likely perpetrators. In the next weeks, however, the Crist investigation was roundly criticized by Moore scholars, by the FDLE investigators, and newspaper editorial boards. It was dismissed as a political attempt to win black votes. Had you ever heard of this case?
Yeah, I had.
This is one of my wish list case. Like, if they could solve a case, like, you know, Maura Murray, Brian Schaefer, JonBenet,
yeah,
and the Moores.
I don't feel like, actually, I feel like the case, I feel like I could say who was at least behind it.
Yeah.
Because clearly the sheriff had something to lose there.
I wondered if he was pressure on him, you know, it's a hit job. It's one of the most interesting hit jobs I've ever seen.
Well, it's actually, it's one of those ironies because neither one of us was alive in 1951, and this type of thing, it's actually even difficult for me to imagine it, except for the fact that historically it happened, right? As far as the racial segregation that's happening here, and the amount of bravery it would have taken to be Harry and Harriet Moore, which, by the way, I just think their names are so cute, Harry and Harriet. But, you know, he was fighting against everything at that point in time. They both were, in that racism was prevalent, and it was so bad that it was ridiculous, really. And this is sort of an illustration of that. And what I mean by that is the fact that he lived his life so bravely with all the accomplishments he made in, or they both made in the civil rights movement, and they died in such a way that the people responsible for their deaths were so cowardly. They put a bomb under their bedroom.
Yeah, this was an improvised explosive device that was made from dynamite that was stuck under their bedroom flooring. And that is definitely, that would be a horrible way.
It is, and it's a complete, it's an act of cowardice. I mean, no question. And I would say it is not a leap, because he called for, I don't think I have the source that you were, from the article you were reading, but it seems like you said that after the sheriff had shot the 2 prisoners in cold blood, killing one, leaving one, that Moore had called for his resignation. Was it the sheriff he called for the resignation of?
No, he called for an indictment. He wanted the sheriff indicted, and he wanted Fuller Warren, who was the governor of Florida at the time, he wanted him to suspend McCall from office because he was the only one who could do it. Sheriffs have a lot of power.
And right, they're elected officials.
Right, and it's very difficult. They're very nuanced ways to formally reprimand a sheriff or do anything to them. The governor has that power, and a lot of times coroners have that power. It depends on the state.
But, I'm sort of aware. I don't know about it really.
He just was demanding something be done for shooting those boys in the back.
Right. And with a witness, I feel like it probably wasn't looking good for, so he wanted the sheriff indicted.
He wanted the sheriff. He wanted the sheriff to face charges for shooting and killing one of the suspects and wounding the other.
Well, right. And so do you have any idea if that ever happened?
Okay, so that case drops off. Like, it basically
disappears?
Well, you can go read individually about them. This is how Irwin's case goes. So Irwin, after this escape attempt where the sheriff shoots him, the sheriff was never indicted or suspended from office or anything like that. But after recovering from the wounds, Walter Irwin gets a retrial. Thurgood Marshall is his defense attorney. He was again found guilty. He was sentenced to death. But in 1955, Leroy Collins, who was the Florida governor at the time, personally reviewed the case and was not convinced of his guilt. So he commuted his sentence from death to life in prison. And in 1968, Irwin was paroled. In 1969, he went down to Lake County, Florida for a visit to some family. And he was found dead, slumped over in his car. For the record, Walter Irwin was a private in World War II in the United States Army. He has a military gravestone. He had a military funeral, and his death was suspicious. So, in my opinion, they had the wrong person. I don't know why they did what they did to him, but they definitely had the wrong person when it comes to Walter Irwin. Now, Shepard obviously died. There's nothing that we can say about. He was fleeing. The impression I got was that shooting was somehow retribution for the rape of Norma Padgett. I don't know that for sure, but I don't think it was necessarily related to Moore. Moore simply wanted justice for them because he felt like they didn't get justice. And he's correct. They didn't get justice. We don't know what really happened. But here's how that event plays out. Do you want to hear about it or?
Well, I was more curious to know if an indictment was brought against Sheriff McCall.
There's an inquest. The NAACP, after the shooting, took on assisting the defense in their appeals. In 1951, Thurgood Marshall is leading the appeals. That's a huge win right there. The U.S. Supreme Court overturns the convictions of both men based on adverse pretrial publicity. They remanded the case back to a lower court for a new trial. When McCall has the shooting incident, this is how it's described. He was transporting Shepard and Irwin from prison back to Lake County Jail in Tavares when he claimed he had a flat tire. So he ends up alone with the two handcuffed prisoners. He pulls down a dirt road to inspect the tire. He claims that Shepard asked to relieve himself, and when the two prisoners, they're cuffed together, when they get out of the car, they attack McCall. He drew his pistol and he shoots at them. The shooting basically is taking place on a dark country road outside of town, but he shoots both of them three times. Shepard's dead instantly. Irwin pretends to be dead. He ends up having to take them into town. Turns out Irwin's alive. So Irwin gets taken to the hospital for treatment. He tells FBI agents and a reporter named Mabel Norris Reese that the shooting was unprovoked. McCall had shot him and Shepard in cold blood, staging the scene, make it look like it was an escape attempt. They said that a Lake County deputy named James Yates had joined McCall at the scene and seen that Irwin was still breathing, and he fired one last shot through Irwin's neck. The FBI were able to confirm there was a bullet buried in the ground beneath Irwin's blood spot that appeared to support his account of the shooting. There was a nail found in the front wheel of McCall's car that appeared to have been his tire trouble. I put that in air quotes if you couldn't see my fingers there. He said he had no idea how the nail got there, but the FBI believed he put it there. So the FBI called for a coroner's inquest, and an all-white coroner's jury showed up, mostly made up of McCall's friends. And they took half an hour to find that Shepard's death was justified. They concluded that McCall had been acting in the line of duty and in self-defense, so he was cleared of any wrongdoing, and no further legal issues were explored.
And when did that happen?
I assume you're asking if the coroner's inquest that was raised was before or after the bombing, right?
I was asking that, and then I was asked, and then I was curious. My point is, did his death stop any possible repercussions? Which it sounds like there weren't going to be any repercussions because a jury, a coroner's jury, found that he was acting in his capacity as sheriff.
The sheriff doesn't really seem to be related back to the Moore incident. Overall, the five criminal investigations into the Moore bombing revealed evidence that seems to implicate four different subjects who are known to be fairly high-ranking members within the Ku Klux Klan in the central region of Florida. Take this with a huge grain of salt, but the idea is that it was Klan versus the NAACP at the time. The first of the four was a guy named Earl J. Brooklyn. He was a Klansman who had a reputation for being violent. He was described as a renegade. He was actually expelled from the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia for engaging in unsanctioned acts of violence. Supposedly, again, grain of salt, Brooklyn was reportedly in possession of floor plans of the Moore home, and that there were witnesses indicating he had been recruiting volunteers to assist in the bombing. The second man was a guy named Tillman Belvin, who went by Curly. He was also reported as a violent member of the Klan and happened to be a close friend of Brooklyn. There was a third man named Joseph Cox. He was implicated by a fellow Klansman named Edward Spivey. Spivey implicated Cox in a deathbed confession. He was dying from late stages of cancer in 1978. Cox committed suicide in 1952, one day after he'd been confronted by the FBI. And Brooklyn and Belvin died while the FBI's initial investigation was being conducted. Natural causes for him in August of 1952. And that was Belvin. Brooklyn died of natural causes on Christmas Day, 1952, 1 year to the day after the bombing. The gist is they blame Harry being so active in civil rights, making him a target of the Klan. No arrests were ever made. All four of those particular people are now deceased. And officially, the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, which was investigating that in a way as a hate crime, albeit before we really understood what hate crimes were, they sort of transferred that to being a hate crime later. And the Civil Rights Division had looked at it. They closed the file in the federal investigation in 2011, citing they could make no more progress from it. This is probably one of the most disturbing cases that I've ever taken a look at all the paperwork on. There is a book about this that's out there. There's a couple of books that relate back to the Moors. There's a good PBS special called Freedom Never Dies, which is the story of Harry Moore. But Harriet Moore is just as powerful as I don't want to not include her in this. But if you're interested in learning more about this, a book that sort of covers what was going on around them called Devil in the Grove. The subtitle for that is Thurgood Marshall, the Groveland Boys, and the Dawn of a New America. And it does a very good job painting how the Groveland 4 case, albeit a very slow one, was a turning point for how the American justice system works today. In some ways very good, in some ways very strange. And how eventually we'll be able to conquer racism, which for some reason we, as a country, struggle with conquering that idea.
Actually, I think we've come a really long way.
We have. We just should do better.
Well, yes, we you should always strive to do better. But in some of the things that I've learned, which we don't, I mean, this just so happens to present a case where I feel like the crime was motivated by a desire against equality.
All of the kids from the Groveland Four were issued posthumous pardons. It took years. It was Governor Ron DeSantis used it as sort of a play on, you know, I hate when politics comes into play on this, but realistically it needed to be done in this case. This is not related directly to the Moors. This is the Groveland rape killers.
They were pardoned?
Yeah, they were finally pardoned posthumously in 2019, but they weren't exonerated until this year. On November 22nd of 2021, Judge Heidi Davis granted the state's motion to posthumously dismiss the indictments of Ernest Thomas and Samuel Shepard, and she vacated the convictions of Charles Greenlee and Walter Irvin. Peaches died in August of 1972 at the age of 44, and Juanita died at the age of 85 in October of 2015. Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabbrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabbrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram, at TrueCrimeXS, or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at truecrimexs@gmail.com, and you can check out our website at www.truecrimexs.com. We'll see you next time.